world. I'm John Batchelor, welcoming Anatole Lieben of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, remarking on the headlines from the Telegraph and from the Financial Times from Europe about Ukraine conflict, and the battle behind the battle in the EU and in the U.S. Congress and in NATO about what is to be done, with some startling revelations from Kyiv about the Ukrainian army being outgunned, outshelled 3-1. That's a Bloomberg report. And also this unusual news, not final, that the president of the country, Mr. Zelensky, deciding not to hold the election as scheduled this year, has fired, asked to be removed. I don't know. There are many verbs here. It's unclear. The general-in-chief of the army, Zaluzhny, who is exceedingly popular and mentioned often as a presidential candidate if that election went forward. The news 24 hours later is that Zaluzhny refuses to go. Anatole, a very good evening to you. Let us begin with the really good news that the EU has finally convinced Viktor Orban of Hungary to stand aside from his objection. They need unanimity at the EU. And their 50 billion euros inbound for Ukraine. Is this the good news that it looks, or are there caveats in all directions? Good evening to you, Anatole.
Hello, John. Well, it is good news, of course. I mean, it's very important news. But the thing is that EU support has been chiefly for the Ukrainian economy. Now, that is, of course, vital, and for Ukrainian government spending in general, because with Ukraine spending virtually its entire budget, I mean, its own money, on the war, without aid from the European Union, I mean, every other service would begin to collapse, including, well, I mean, not only essential services for the population, but ancillary services like hospitals, which are essential for the war. So this is very important, but it's not clear to what degree it will contribute, to actual weapons and equally important ammunition for Ukraine, because the German Chancellor Scholz admitted again recently that the EU is going to miss its target, miss by a long way, its target of providing 1 million artillery shells to Ukraine this spring. And the European militaries have been so run down, I mean, including those of Ukraine's greatest supporters like Britain, that it's not clear actually how much they have left to give to Ukraine without stripping their own arsenals. So, I mean, this is very important, but it's not going to be decisive.
I want to follow through on the EU, because there are political voices around the world, especially in the United States, saying repeatedly, this is Europe's fight, none of our affair. And you know that there are more extreme ways to say that. There's a presidential campaign underway. How does Europe hear that when the U.S. one more time says NATO's none of our affair?
Well, very nervously. I mean, very belatedly, the Europeans have woken up to the fact that, Trump may win in November and what that will mean for Europe. But of course, this is a cruder way of saying something that every U.S. president since Eisenhower has said, either more loudly or more softly, which is that Europe must spend more on its own defense. But of course, there is an ambiguity here, because on the other hand, whenever Europe or anyone in Europe then starts to talk about strategic autonomy, in other words, European countries making up their own minds about security and international affairs and not bowing to Washington, then of course the U.S. establishment immediately lashes back against that and gets very angry. So there's a rather schizophrenic attitude to this in America. But certainly the Europeans are getting nervous. And of course, European military budgets are increasing. But the problem is that There was a report in the Financial Times the other day that this is not something you can do overnight. It's not just that European military industries don't have the capacity to ramp themselves up quickly when it comes to weapons. It's not just that there are still huge obstacles to one of the most important things, which is countries actually agreeing to pool their military production and military resources instead of every country doing it on its own, which is disastrous, of course, for military planning. But the Europeans are having enormous difficulty, as I said, even in producing more shells. And there's a fascinating story that one of the reasons is that we just don't have the skilled labor anymore. This is not something which can be done, entirely by automation. It needs, highly skilled laborers if the shells are actually, to explode and not to explode prematurely. And we don't have enough of them anymore. Well, that, of course, means it requires training, it requires recruitment, it requires, a quite radical change in economic policy as it has existed for the past two generations. It's not something you can do overnight, and, the Ukrainians need help very quickly.
I learned from a new book by a colleague of yours, Nick Bunker, an historian in England, In the Shadow of Fear, this amazing fact, Anatole. In 1950, Truman was in the White House, and the Marshall Plan had been initially very successful in reviving the European economy after the tragedy of the Second War. The Republicans, what a surprise, were against any more funds flowing through on the Marshall Initiative. They were also against putting the U.S. at risk with the newborn NATO that Eisenhower was conversant with, but Eisenhower was raising money at Columbia University when he was then president. In other words, 1950 looks a whole lot like 2024 when it comes to the American opinion of why should we help Europe? They don't help us. It is odd to consider that the voices in Washington, if they do have memory of 1950, they're not evidencing it. I found it in this book, and I'm going to conclude by saying you and I have grown up in a period of time where this tension is always there, and it was there from the beginning. Is there an answer to it, or are we just going to live with the fact that in America there is an isolationist voice that will not be stilled?
Yes, I mean, I've studied that period, and it's a very odd combination which still affects the Republican Party to a great extent, which is that, on the one hand, many of them, not all, remain, of course, intensely hawkish. I mean, it's not that the Republicans in the early 50s were pro-communist, God knows, or soft on communism, but they absolutely instinctively, viscerally dislike the idea of America being in alliances and therefore have to defer to any extent to allies and their wishes. They want America basically to do everything on its own, but then, a bit like, the first Gulf War against Iraq, America will decide everything and other people will pay for it. Well, that is, to put it mildly, a little bit contradictory, and it's not going to work.
Moving to other problems, and let's go to the one that seems the most gossipy. This is a CNN report. I mentioned earlier the Telegraph has two sides of the report. One, that Mr. Zelensky is going to dismiss General Zaluzhny. The other, that General Zaluzhny refuses to be dismissed. And now we have CNN reporting in these last hours. President Zelensky may dismiss the head of Ukraine's armed forces, Zaluzhny, within days, while Zaluzhny refused an invitation to resign during a meeting on Monday. CNN said that Zelensky may push him out anyway using a presidential decree. This is mighty strange for a country that is in the midst of a war with an overwhelming aggressor. Very strange. Of course, Peskov and the apparatus in the Kremlin not only are taking advantage of this, they're preening themselves on the basis of this news. How should we hear it in the United States, Anatole?
Well, the war is not going well. And, you know, obviously, everybody in Kiev is now seeking to blame their rivals or anybody else but themselves for the fact that the war is not going well. So that is the background thing. The second thing, and what seems to have brought this to a head, is that Zaluzhny has been insisting, by the way, I mean, completely rightly from a military point of view, but more and more loudly, that the government must conscript many more men. Because if not, with a population a quarter the size of Russia's and having suffered immense casualties, Ukraine will simply run out of troops and will lose. But tightening conscription is becoming more and more unpopular in Ukrainian society. When a bill to tighten conscription was presented to the Ukrainian parliament in recent weeks, they turned it down because it was going to bring much tougher sanctions and to bear on draft dodgers and recruit much larger sectors of the population. And now, the other thing there, as far as Parliament is concerned, is to remember that, you know, as I found when I was in Ukraine, what causes immense resentment among the troops, but also in the poorer parts of the country and sectors of the population, is this belief, which seems to be entirely correct, by the way, that the elites, including the political elites, their children are evading military service. There's a big issue in Russia as well, by the way. But of course, guess where the elites are concentrated? Well, it's the Ukrainian parliament. So anyway, Zaluzhny has become more and more vocal in public about this. Zelensky is, caught between a rock and a hard place there because he could simply overrule Parliament and do this by decree, under martial law. But then that would really stir up political opposition to him. But if he doesn't do it, well, yes, I mean, he's going to face more and more criticism from the military. And that is, well, I mean, obviously, they could also lose the war. Apparently the average age of their troops is now over 40. Well, that is, as we know, I mean, after a certain age, you don't live in a trench for months on end in winter and end up being able to fight. But the other thing, of course, to keep in mind is that, as now everyone says, and once again, as I heard from all the analysts when I was there last year, there is a general expectation that at some stage, General Zaluzhny will run for president, either in succession to Zelensky or against Zelensky. And so, Zelensky clearly is also thinking about getting rid of not just a potential rival, an actual rival. But that would be, I mean, that's why clearly he wanted Zaluzhny to resign himself, and we don't know what incentives or possible threats, I don't know, were offered to get Zaluzhny to do that. Because for Zelensky to fire Zaluzhny in disgrace would, I think, be very, very unpopular in the Ukrainian army. He is popular. He is seen as a key leader who stopped the Russians in the first months of the war and drove them back. But also, this would be seen in the military as blaming the army for a failure last year, which, of course, the army thinks was really not its fault, that, it just did not have the weapons or the ammunition or the men, and that they were pushed, into an offensive, which was made for political, not military reasons. And there was great anger in the military, from what I gather, last fall when Zaluzhny said, once again, and completely correctly from a military point of view, that for a considerable time to come, Ukraine simply had to go on to the defensive and hold its existing positions, that it was not able to launch a successful offensive. And Zelensky initially bitterly criticized him and said, no, we're going to go on attacking. And then after a couple of weeks, Zelensky, apparently also on very strong advice from Washington, had to reverse that position and accept, yes, that a defensive war is now necessary. But that caused tremendous bad blood between Zaluzhny and Zelensky, and to some extent between the army and the government, because, you know, soldiers who are by now, after all, very experienced soldiers, but also soldiers, you know, who have seen so many of their comrades die or be wounded, you know, do not like the idea that they're going to be driven into hopeless First World War style slaughters, you know, against all military sense and logic.
Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.